You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We continue now our conversation with lifelong free speech advocate Bill Mandel.
William Mandel, I read where you're about 86 years old now. Is that correct?
I'm 86.
86. How many political social movements have you watched unfold and actually been a part of over the last, I guess, 60 or 70 years or so?
It's an interesting question, because what I do now chiefly is to urge people to buy my autobiography, which is called Saying No to Power.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I wrote an autobiography, I feel that, as a general rule, let someone else write about you. Then, if someone else does choose to write a biography, then if you write an autobiography, it's all right. But I felt that what I wanted to do was to answer the question you just put to me, to describe the history of the American people's struggles for everything, North and South, student struggles, African American struggles, labor struggles, peace struggles. I've been in quite literally almost everything of a progressive nature since the age of 10. I was raised in that kind of family since the age of 10.
Mm-hmm.
And with the exception, I am not a war veteran, and I was not a farmer. So with those, the exception of those two movements, it's really hard to name one that I have not been in. This autobiography is an attempt to tell the history of the American people's struggles in my lifetime through the human approach of the participation of a particular individual in them.
Mm-hmm. I know you opposed anti-Semitism and Zionism, and I'm wondering, how would you place what's occurring right now in the West Bank and Gaza in historical context?
In that case, I'm going to answer with something emotional that I hope I can get through. My wife died 2 years ago. And I keep on my wall a blow-up of her last letter to the editor, June 8th, 2001, which answers your question. I am an 84-year-old Jewish woman sitting here crying because I am not physically capable of going to the Women in Black Vigil in San Francisco against Israeli mistreatment of the Palestinians. I urge any open-minded and fair-minded person to look at the map and see that supposedly Palestinian Gaza and the West Bank are crisscrossed with Jewish settlements and roads connecting them. I am filled with shame for Israel for allowing Jews from all over the world to come live there and become citizens while not allowing Palestinians to return to their native land. I urge everyone, particularly Jews, to write to the President and to Congress asking them, one, to participate in enforcing UN Security Council Resolution 242, requiring Israel to withdraw from Arab territories occupied since the 1967 war. This means abandonment of the settlements. Two, to grant Palestinians the right to return to their homes in the West Bank and Israel. That's her position then. It's my position now.
Thank you for sharing that with us.
You're very welcome, I'm sure.
William Mandel, in your autobiography, Saying No to Power, you speak about your life as a political activist and an advocate of free speech. You were expelled from college in 1933 for taking part in an anti-ROTC protest and refusing to apologize. At the age of 18, you became a teacher of Marxism in the Communist Party's Workers' School in New York. You helped Paul Robeson put on a concert in 1950 at a time when he was blacklisted. The following year, you participated in one of the first freedom rides in the South, and all your activism eventually led yourself being blacklisted from publishing and academic employment for close to two decades. You, as you've said, were also a broadcaster at KPFA in Berkeley for about 30 years.
37. I broadcast on WBAI before it was given to Pacifica, but starting the broadcast we carried from Berkeley starting in 1958.
Now, given all these experiences, how do you interpret the current state of the country with Bush in office and preemptive war, now apparently a foreign policy strategy?
The Bush administration has gone on the basis of a cold-blooded and very simplistic interpretation of certain facts. It is a fact that the United States is the wealthiest country in the world. It is a fact that we have, by beyond any comparison, the strongest military, the best air force, the most nuclear bombs. We're the only country that ever used them. The logical conclusion from that, by people like Cheney, who to me is about as evil a person as has walked the earth, the logical conclusion is, well, then we should rule the world. It's no longer necessary for us to have to wrestle with sometimes unwilling allies in NATO, even though we invented NATO and we run NATO. So we should rule the world. And to do so, we do what every empire, and by the way, to me, a rather amazing thing. You have to understand that here again, my age and experience plays a role. I grew up in a time when Americans hated imperialism, even though we were an imperialist country. They did not realize that. I was invited to debate the co-author of the book The Ugly American, a title that's still well known. He was a major poli-sci prof at UC Berkeley. And I made the political mistake of using the term imperialism to describe American policy. It was perfectly accurate. This was the beginning of the Cold War. So it is amazing to me to find that this year, specifically since the beginning of the war in Iraq, that large sections of the press, major columnists, major pundits, they're saying, hey, sure, we're an empire, so what? We're the guys, we're the man. Now, what has occurred is that even the administration has discovered that this is a role that this country cannot play. And by the way, one very good thing has to be said about the American people in this respect. It's contradictory. On the one hand, Americans don't get all that troubled by our killing of other people. I'm speaking of the mass, the majority view. But we don't want Americans to be killed in wars. It's a very unusual, historically, an extremely unusual situation. It's perfectly true that there have been pacifists of one kind or another throughout history, Jesus Christ being perhaps the most famous in the history of our civilization.
Yes.
But the notion of a people, a major people, with 300 million of us, having come to the conclusion we don't want our sons and our daughters killed in a war, and the government pursues a policy that leads to that, we want out. Which, of course, is a consequence of the Vietnam War, which all of us on the left and not so far left can be very proud of playing a role in stopping. So there is, at this moment, a split at the very top with Colin Powell taking the lead and with many of the professional military agreeing, saying that in Iraq, either we've got to send in the kind of numbers that we sent in Vietnam, 500,000. And of course, we didn't win in Vietnam, but we faced a different situation. We faced an organized opposition, brilliant military leaders, Giap, Ho Chi Minh is a great political leader. Nothing of that kind at present exists in Iraq. Either we've got to send in 500,000 men and keep them there indefinitely and spend the unbelievable sums, which may very well create a 1929 in this country overnight at any time, because an awful lot of our money is money that comes as investments from Europeans. And at some point, they're going to wonder whether the U.S. is a safe place to invest. Mm-hmm. In all events, that split is occurring. And as I tried unsuccessfully to urge upon the Communist Party during the Korean War, when a similar split occurred because we didn't win in Korea, we settled with a 50-50 deal, I urged that we recognize there's a split at the top of society at that time for some reason that isn't very clear to me. The Boston group of big capital expressed in the press through the Boston Globe and to a considerable degree associated with the Chicago group, Chicago Tribune, they came to oppose the war in Korea.
Mm.
And I urged the left at that time to say, look, we and they can never be allies, but we both have the same attitude. For goodness sake, let's do that.
Mm.
And I regret to say that the head of the Communist Party, August Hall, recently deceased, didn't think we should dirty our hands by doing anything that in any way took the same kind of position.
Mm.
So the end of this one simply is that I think that the world is a multipolar place, that China and India cannot be ignored, that Russia still has, weak as it is economically, still is the one other country on the face of the earth that can blow the world to smithereens. We and they have that unique decision. And under those circumstances, the issue before us at the present time is to reverse our foreign policy. I'll tell you that as an individual, I will be voting almost certainly for a Democratic candidate this year, and it will be only the second time in my life. I've been voting since 1940.
Hmm. Is that right? Why so?
Pardon me?
Why so? Why will you be voting this time?
I will be voting to oust Bush. In short, this is a situation in which I feel that we have an administration that is dangerous to our country, dangerous to the world, and that it's got to be ousted. So that I'm setting aside my very severe criticisms of the Democratic Party and who they represent. And to me, any candidate who looks as though he will change the present foreign policy is the candidate I would vote for. Very briefly, my man is Kucinich, but he's running 1%. Dean is the person I hope for. I do not idealize him for various reasons. I see him as being very much like Roosevelt. Franklin Roosevelt.
Mm-hmm.
He did not have an ideology. He came into office with one purpose, to save American capitalism at the bottom of a terrible depression. And he listened, and he shifted, and he made whatever deals are necessary, and he made the concessions to the people that were necessary. Dean is remarkably like that. He is also from the aristocracy. His father is Dean of Dean Witter. In some ways, an unusual man. But the point is that I would probably vote for any Democrat except Lieberman. And my objection to Lieberman, I am both Jewish, my objection to Lieberman is that his loyalty to Israel is of a level that would probably continue our present policy, but under a Democratic president instead of a Republican.
Mm. And what about General Wesley Clark?
What about?
He has just entered the race, General Wesley Clark.
Wesley Clark, that's an amazing proposal. Wesley Clark bombed Yugoslavia for 80 days, bombed the country whose people and whose government could not hurt us in any way if they wanted to. He had no opposition in the air, so the bombing of the Chinese embassy, we had pinpoint bombers. Those pinpoint bombers work unless you compel them to dodge. He bombed the Chinese embassy as a way of saying to China, we do not like your disagreement with our policy. Get out, keep out. And by the way, it is important politically that China is totally convinced of what I just said. I happen to be convinced of it, but that is China's position.
Mm-hmm.
He did something which was quite wild. Toward the end of the war, you know that Putin, Russia, came in, well, Yeltsin at that time, it was supposedly allies, and there were some Russian forces in Yugoslavia. There still are. The Russian military did an end run around Yeltsin and sent a force to take over the airport at a place called Pristina, Pristina, the major airport in Kosovo, which is what this war was about. I'll get back to that in a moment. Clark ordered the British general under his command. The British general has made this public in recent months. Clark ordered the British general in his command to force the Russians out by force. The Russians were a military force. And the British general answered, I am not going to start World War III to satisfy your ego. So what this fuss is about Clark, frankly, I don't get. One more thing which is of considerable importance. The reason for the Yugoslav War, the Kosovo War of 1999, is that American oil interests, remember that the oil interests do not give their money to only one party. Mm-hmm. American oil interests wanted to be able to build a pipeline from a Black Sea port in Bulgaria across the Balkans, terminating on the Adriatic in a port in Albania, which would then enable that oil to go via tanker to Europe. It would be brought across the Black Sea from the Caucasus, mm-hmm. which was formerly the Soviet Union. Albania said to us, there'll be no port in Albania unless Kosovo becomes Albanian. Kosovo is ethnically today majority Albanian. Mm-hmm. It was the actual founding area of the of Yugoslavia, the Serbs' history.
Yes, yes.
You know. At all events, I do not, for the life of me, understand this fuss over Wesley Clark. When I spoke of Dean earlier, and mm-hmm. there's information that Dean is asking Clark to run as his vice presidential candidate, that relates to my opinion about Franklin Roosevelt. One of Roosevelt's last actions, which turned out to be a fatal mistake, was that he replaced his previous vice president, Henry Wallace, who would have pursued Roosevelt's policy of mm-hmm. peace before existence, mm-hmm. with Harry Truman. And when Roosevelt died, Truman, he felt he needed Truman to win the solid South, which at that time was Democratic, whites-only voting. So that I can see Dean going with Clark as a vice presidential candidate. Mm-hmm. At all events, I certainly personally do not see Clark as somebody I could support.
I see. Finally, William Mandel, you are also a poet, and I understand you've agreed to share your poem with us as we close our discussion, our conversation down.
Before I read this, let me explain three words. In the first place, since it was written November 19, 50 years ago, so you've got to imagine a young father, me, 34, reading it at that time, writing it at that time. So I'll use the language of the day. Therefore, I use the word Negro instead of Black or African American.
Yes, sir.
Secondly, there are two geographic names that will not be meaningful to you, to most people. I refer to Cicero and to Martinsville. Cicero was a city in Illinois that Al Capone ran, and it happened to be maybe the most racist city in the North, where some of the very nasty things had happened. Martinsville was a city in the South, or is a city in the mountains of Virginia, where early that year, also 1951, I had participated in what might have been called a premature freedom ride. 500 of us from all over the country, half black, half white, and also half labor union people, half other people, in an unsuccessful attempt to stop the execution of seven black men who were executed. Mm. So that those three words will have meaning. This is November 1951. Du Bois had just been acquitted of conspiracy for heading a collection of 1 million American signatures to a petition against another use of the nuclear bomb. It's called For My Children, to Dr. Du Bois. I, a white man, speak these lines for my children, too young to write but old enough to know of jails and war. Bobby is 7 and Davy is 5. My little boys want to stay alive. Bobby, he asked me the other day, Daddy, will I have to go away and fight and kill when I grow up? Davy looked up from his breakfast cup and said, I want to know that, too. Answer me, Daddy. I answered them true. Wars, I said, don't have to be. People can live like you and me, loving each other and sharing our bread. But men there are who'd see us dead to make them richer. They are few, but tell the government what to do. They own the papers that tell the lies to make us blame the other guys. Across the seas they stretch their hands to take things made in other lands. They whip and kill and burn and maim with bombers and with jellied flame to make the people far away do the things our rich men say. To fight and die in grim despair, their children will not have to bear. They'll sit at desks and hand out orders to the boys at war beyond our borders. It's you they want, I told my sons, to sleep in mud and face the guns, to murder people you've never seen, and spill red blood upon the green of field and valley, hill and park. They want to make our country dark and dumb and deaf and stony blind, so none can stand and speak his mind for peace, for life, for milk and bread, and say, I don't want my children dead. That's why I travel about this land, warning the people whenever I can. My daughter is 12 and knows the score. She sees the greed of the men of war. She knows they are hard and cruel and grim. She's seen the light of freedom grow dim. Herself, she's brave, and her pride is great that we stand with those who bar the gates to death and hunger and cold and fear and hold back the war from year to year. But child she is, and much afraid of the FBI and a midnight raid. Daddy, she said, they'll put you in jail. They'll hold you and keep you without any bail. That may yet be, was my reply. But they've tried and failed with others than I. Du Bois, a man of 84, they dragged to court and locked the door. His wrists they bound in iron bands because they fear the mighty hands that wrote in verse and prose and law for all to read. We'll fight no war, while those whose skins are dark like mine must eat their bread and drink their wine apart, must die for want of precious care, must gasp for lack of precious air in holes where rats, not men, should live. We'll fight no war, no blood we'll give abroad when Cicero is here. Martinsville, too, is here, when war is waged by the very police whose oath it is to keep the peace. And bullets take a deadly toll of Negroes who would use the poll to sample this democracy and get a taste of being free. His voice they thought forever to still. A year in jail would kill this patriarch. But they forgot that a people once bound to slavery's rack will not go back, will not betray the faith of those who show the way. Their voices resounded from shore to shore and mounted to a single roar of mighty protest. And with them joined the voice of protest of people white of skin. Du Bois is free, and that, my children, means freedom for me. The hounds of terror are not at rest, but north and south and east and west the people speak. The people, yes. And those who dealt the strongest blow to free us all are those who know that they have freedom least of all. My children said, they keep us free. We must say thanks. I answered, fighters be, that the Negro people have liberty. That's it.
William Mandel, thank you so very much for your passion, your profundity, a life that is a virtual living history book, a legend. Thank you for putting things into proper perspective, proper historical context for us this afternoon on Peace Watch.
Thank you very much for having me on, and I will take advantage of this last minute to say you can get it all in full on paper to read, to study, to enjoy in my autobiography, Saying No to Power, which can be acquired through all the normal sources. Thank you.
Bill Mandel is a veteran political activist, free speech advocate, and longtime Pacifica broadcaster. His recent autobiography is entitled Saying No to Power. For more info on Bill Mandel, you can visit his website at www.billmandel.net. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is T from the Pattersons taking the train to Tibet. We have production assistance from Matt Bradley, Sam Husseini, and Yolanda Turner. Thanks to Pete Karakis, RadioForAll.net, and Alex Mitchell at WebActive.com for web help. It's your financial support that makes Peace Watch possible, so we urge you to make a generous donation through our secure online website at Pacifica.org. Or you can send your donations to Pacifica Radio, 2390 Champlain Street, Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20009. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the show. You can send us your feedback at peacewatch@pacifica.org. You can also visit webactive.com to listen to archives of past Peace Watch programs. To get a copy of this show, call the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.